Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
We wake up every morning with a profound, almost unshakable assumption about who we are.
Yes, we really do.
We open our eyes and we feel this seamless continuity with the person who went to sleep the night before. You know, we feel as though there is a singular, unchanging agent behind our eyes.
A sort of captain steering the ship.
Exactly. A captain steering the ship of our lives through all the turbulent waters of daily experience. And when anxiety arises over a looming deadline, or when frustration boils over sitting in traffic.
Right, the everyday friction.
Yeah, or even when we desperately crave the arrival of the weekend. We experience all these states as happening to a solid, enduring me.
We do.
And we suffer because this me feels constantly threatened. You know, it's perpetually unfulfilled and just relentlessly driven by this cycle of temporary highs and inevitable lows.
Exhausting.
It is. And we just accept this friction as the fundamental reality of the human condition. But the tradition we are engaging with today challenges that foundational assumption at its very root.
It really pulls the rug out from under it.
It suggests that this me and all the suffering it endures is not a static reality at all. It's actually a dynamic, constructed process.
Yes. The core proposition here is that our suffering isn't random, and it's certainly not a permanent fixture of our identity.
Right.
It is the result of a highly specific, observable chain of causes and conditions. And the beauty of this teaching is that if we can observe the mechanics of how our experience is constructed moment by moment, we're no longer passive victims of that experience.
Which is incredibly empowering.
It is. So today we are exploring the SOOTRA teaching, the fundamental exposition and detailed analysis of dependent arising.
A truly profound text.
Very much so. It's a central canonical text from the Tibetan Buddhist canon. And it was recently translated into English by the 84,000 Project, which is this remarkable initiative dedicated to translating the entirety of the Buddha's teachings into modern languages.
And the gravity of this specific text really cannot be overstated. We are looking at a teaching that was delivered at the Jeddah Grove in Srivasti.
An ancient sanctuary.
Right. A monastery situated in a park donated by a wealthy benefactor named Anathapita. And here, the Buddha is addressing a gathering of monks, offering them what is essentially the blueprint of samsara.
The cycle of continuous conditioned existence.
Exactly. The goal of our discussion today is to systematically examine this ancient framework. We want to understand how a philosophy articulated over two millennia ago diagnoses the micromechanics of human perception, reaction, and ultimately suffering.
And it does so with such precision.
It does. And the text begins with a fundamental formula. It's a statement of conditional causality. The Buddha states, if this exists, that arises. By this having been produced, that is produced.
That is the core premise. The fundamental exposition.
Right. But when encountering this phrasing, I think the modern mind instinctively maps it onto Newtonian physics, you know?
Oh, absolutely. We want it to be simple cause and effect.
Yeah, we picture a line of dominoes. You push the first one, and linear deterministic gravity just does the rest. Or we think of a hard-coded computer algorithm where input A strictly guarantees output B.
A very mechanical view.
But relying on those linear models seems to strip away the possibility of agency. And if there's no agency, that would render the entire spiritual path kind of pointless, wouldn't it? Is this just basic physics, cause and effect?
Well, applying a rigid linear determinism to the concept of pratitasamutpada.
Dependent arising.
Yes, dependent arising. Applying that linear view is a really common interpretive hazard. It goes far beyond mere physical cause and effect.
How so?
Well, a linear domino analogy implies a strict chronological sequence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the cause ceases entirely to exist before the effect takes place. And it implies that one singular cause is solely responsible for one singular effect.
Right, which is too simplistic.
Exactly. It's about moral causation and the nature of reality itself. The formulation, if this exists, that arises, describes something far more organic and multidimensional.
So, not dominoes.
No. Rather than a line of dominoes, the causality described here is more akin to an incredibly complex ecological system, or perhaps a murmuration of starlings in the sky.
Oh, I like that image.
Right. The movement of one bird conditions the movement of the flock, but the flock simultaneously provides the context for the individual bird's movement. Causes and conditions are interwoven.
So they arise together.
Yes. Think of a seed. A seed requires soil, water, sunlight, and time to produce a sprout.
Yeah.
None of those conditions are the sole primary cause.
Right.
And the sprout does not exist independently of them. It establishes that nothing animate or inanimate exists independently.
Yeah, all connected.
Entirely. When the text applies this principle to the human experience, it is establishing that every single mental state, every perception, every moment of suffering arises strictly in reliance on a vast web of preceding and simultaneous conditions.
There's no single origin point.
Exactly. There is no unmoved mover, no independent self orchestrating the process from outside the web.
That conceptual shift, moving from a linear chain of events happening to a self to an interdependent web of conditions that actually constructs the illusion of the self, that's a massive leap.
It's the essential threshold.
Right. It's the threshold we have to cross to understand the rest of the esotra. And the Buddha begins tracing this construction with the foundational condition, the very first link.
Link number one.
He states that through the condition of ignorance, formations arise. And I find it fascinating that the text doesn't leave ignorance as just some abstract concept.
No, it is highly specific.
It provides the staggering, exhaustive definition. The esotra defines ignorance as not knowing the past, the future, the inner, or the outer.
And it continues. It's not knowing actions and their maturation.
Right.
It is not knowing the Buddha, the Dharma, the Samiga.
Which is the entire refuge of the practitioner.
Exactly. And it goes on to specify it as not knowing suffering, its origin, its cessation, or the path.
The Four Noble Truths.
Yes. And finally, not knowing virtue and non-virtue, or what is bad, sublime, negative, or positive.
Reading this extensive catalog of, well, not knowing, it's really tempting to view ignorance merely as a passive absence of information.
Like a lack of intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. Like an empty hard drive just waiting to be filled with data. Yet when we look at the psychological reality of our daily suffering, it suggests something much more aggressive than just a blank slate.
That's a crucial observation. Treating ignorance as a mere deficit of data entirely misses the mechanical function it plays in this philosophy.
It's not just not knowing facts.
No. The latter part of the Esototo's definition clarifies this by describing ignorance as being confused, deluded, and obscured about the nature of dependent arising itself.
Ah.
In the Abhidharma traditions, which provide the psychological scaffolding for these Esototras, ignorance is understood not as a passive blankness, but as an active, continuous misapprehension of reality.
Active misapprehension.
Yes. It is a reifying force. We actively project permanence onto phenomena that are impermanent.
Mm-hmm.
We actively project the potential for lasting satisfaction onto phenomena that are inherently incapable of providing it.
We're constantly layering our own reality over the actual one.
Precisely. And most critically, we actively project an independent, inherent essence onto our own identity. This active misperception is the soil from which the entire cycle grows.
Because if we misperceive reality,
we are compelled to act in ways to defend and satisfy this illusory independent self.
And that active misapprehension bridges us directly into the next phase of the process. Link number two.
Formations.
Right. If we are operating under the false premise that we are a solid, isolated entity constantly under threat or constantly in need of external validation, we generate momentum.
We certainly do.
The Esotra states that conditioned by ignorance, formations arise. And to break this down simply, the text categorizes these into formations of the body, speech, and mind.
Yes.
To borrow from your ecology metaphor earlier, if ignorance is the polluted soil, formations are the toxic roots spreading outward.
That's a very apt visual.
Every physical gesture, every spoken word, every internal volition or thought driven by this act of confusion generates a karmic footprint.
Yes. The Sanskrit term here is saskara, which is translated as formations. And it carries the connotation of constructing or putting together.
Putting together our future experience.
Exactly. It represents volitional action, the karmic impulse. Whenever an action is motivated by the cognitive obscuration of ignorance, whether it's an action rooted in greed to acquire things for the self, or anger to push things away from this self act, it leaves a residual imprint.
It doesn't just dissipate.
No, it never just dissipates. These volitional actions are the energetic momentum that propels the cycle forward. They are the architects of our future experiences.
So an example would be?
Well, think of a moment of intense anger. It does not just vanish when the shouting stops.
Right. Your heart rate is still up. Your mind is racing.
And deeper than that, it conditions the mind. It lowers the threshold for anger to arise again in the future. It shapes how the mind will encounter future objects.
So the roots keep growing. And the text then tells us that, conditioned by these formations, consciousness arises. This is link 3.
Yes, consciousness.
And this is where the metaphysical physics of the text become highly complex. The Esso Otra specifically lists 6 collections of consciousness.
The consciousnesses of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind.
Right. So we are talking about the bare cognitive apprehension of phenomena, but I think there's a hurdle here. How does the energetic residue of past actions, these formations we just discussed, how do they actually generate or condition a new moment of awareness?
It's a leap.
It seems like a huge gap between a past karmic action and a present moment of just seeing a tree or hearing a bird.
It's a very perceptive question.
Mm-hmm.
And the continuity between formations and consciousness is actually a central subject of debate and analysis in Buddhist philosophy.
I can see why.
Formations carry the karmic momentum from past actions. They act as the propulsive force that directs consciousness toward its next object, or, on a macro level, its next existence.
Okay.
Think of formations as the trajectory and velocity of an arrow that's already in flight.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And consciousness is the arrow itself landing on its target. The consciousness described here is the fundamental awareness that allows for the experience of an object.
So it's not the content of the experience, just the awareness itself.
Exactly. The 6 collections the Esso Otra lists are the 6 types of cognitive awareness corresponding to the 6 sensory domains. Without the propulsive force of prior volitional actions, there would be no momentum for this consciousness to engage with the world.
So the karma literally directs what we become aware of.
It does.
Now, this fundamental awareness propelled by past momentum requires a structure in which to operate. And that brings us to link 4. The Esso Otra states that conditioned by consciousness, name and form arises.
Name and form.
Yeah. In previous eras, commentators might have used the analogy of a chariot, you know, the wheels, the axle, the carriage coming together to make the chariot.
A classic analogy.
But a modern mind often reaches for the distinction between hardware and software. We might equate the physical body to the hardware and the mental faculties to the software.
It's a tempting modernization.
It is. But I have to ask you to unpack the text's specific definitions here, because while functional, that binary feels too rigid, maybe too mechanical, to capture the fluidity of this concept.
You're right. The hardware and software analogy is a bit too static.
What's a better way to look at it?
Well, if we think about a standing waves in a river, the water is constantly rushing through, changing every millisecond. Yet the form of the wave remains seemingly solid due to the underlying conditions of the riverbed and the current.
The water is always new, but the shape stays the same.
Yes. The self is perhaps more like that standing wave. It's a far more accurate representation of the Buddhist concept of the aggregates.
The aggregates being the components of a person.
Correct. The text defines name as the 4 formless aggregates: feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness.
So that's the mental side.
Yes, these are the constantly shifting immaterial mental factors. And form is defined as the 4 great elements: earth, water, fire, and wind.
Which represent physical properties.
Exactly. Solidity, cohesion, temperature, and motion. And any form derived from them. The psychophysical organism is an ongoing process of physical and mental events arising and passing away.
Just like the water in the standing wave.
Exactly. Consciousness relies on name and form to have a localized presence. And name and form relies on consciousness to be animated.
They need each other.
They support each other mutually, much like 2 sheaves of reeds leaning against one another. If you remove one, the other falls. Together, they create the illusion of a solid self. But they are entirely absent of any enduring, independent substance.
So, to summarize where we are, we've moved from a fundamental misunderstanding of reality, which was ignorance, through the karmic momentum of formations, which propelled consciousness, into the literal building blocks of a sentient being, name and form.
We have the architecture of experience.
We do. A being ready to experience the world. And that takes us into the next phase, link 5. Conditioned by name and form, the 6 inner sense sources arise.
The faculties.
Right. The faculties of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. The organism is now equipped to perceive. And the Esso Otra immediately follows this with link 6, stating that conditioned by the sense sources, contact arises.
Yes.
The text refers to the 6 collections of contact, which is being conjoined with the respective sense organ.
Eye, ear, nose, and so forth.
Exactly. Now, this microphenomenology of a moment is critical. Contact isn't merely a physical object bumping into a physical body.
No, it's not a physical collision.
It's the precise intersection of 3 elements, right? The visual form, the visual organ, and the visual consciousness.
Yes, the convergence of those three, object, faculty, and awareness, is what constitutes contact. It is the epistemological event of perception.
The spark.
The spark, exactly. The eye alone cannot see. A corpse has eyes, but no visual consciousness.
Right, grim but true.
And consciousness alone cannot see without the faculty of the eye and the presence of a form. When these three conditions align, the spark of experience occurs.
And we usually miss this entirely.
We do. The text demands that we slow down our observation of our own minds to witness this exact fraction of a second, because we tend to collapse the entire process into a single, solid block of experience.
We just say, I saw true.
Exactly. We embed our entire identity and the tree's supposed inherent existence into the event. The esoetra deconstructs the event into its component parts, revealing a mechanical process completely devoid of an independent observer.
It's just conditions meeting conditions.
That's all it is.
And the immediate, unavoidable byproduct of that collision is link 7. Conditioned by contact, feeling arises.
Feeling.
And the text categorizes these feelings simply but profoundly into three distinct hedonic tones. Pleasure, pain, and neither pleasure nor pain.
Neutral feeling.
Right. It is really vital to emphasize that at this specific stage in the sequence, feeling is just raw data. It is the initial, almost biological evaluation of the contact.
It hasn't become a story yet.
Exactly. A sound wave hits the auditory faculty, consciousness engages, and the resulting tone is unpleasant. Or a chemical compound touches the tongue faculty, consciousness engages, and the resulting tone is pleasant. There is no moral weight to this feeling. It's an automatic result of the preceding conditions.
It is an involuntary conditioned response. However, what occurs in the fraction of a second after the feeling arises dictates the entire trajectory of our suffering.
This is the turning point.
It really is. The esoetra states that conditioned by feeling, craving arises. Link 8.
Right.
This is the critical juncture in the entire cycle of dependent arising. Craving is the thirst. It's the visceral demand that a pleasant feeling be sustained and amplified, or that an unpleasant feeling be eradicated.
It's the transition from raw data to agonizing desire.
Yes. The text identifies three types of craving. Craving of the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm.
Across all cosmologies.
But in our immediate human experience, it is the mechanism that turns a momentary physical ache into a sprawling mental narrative of distress. Or a passing pleasant taste into an insatiable hunger for more.
And I really want to zero in on this transition from link 7 feeling to link 8 craving. Because for you listening, this is where the trap snaps shut in daily life.
Every single day.
For example, you're scrolling social media, you see a post that's contact, you feel a twinge of jealousy that's feeling, and immediately you want something you don't have, or you want to lash out, that's craving.
Your momentum takes over.
So I have to ask, if feeling naturally, automatically arises from contact, is craving inevitable? Are we just doomed to follow the dominoes?
That is the most important question for a practitioner. The mechanics of how feeling triggers craving represent the exact point where contemplative practice intervenes.
The intervention.
Yes. The entire edifice of insight meditation, or vipassana, seems aimed at this specific synapse. If the transition from feeling to craving is an automatic, hardwired reflex governed by ignorance, then yes, we are trapped.
Well, we are.
No. If we possess the capacity to inject awareness into that specific gap, to observe a pleasant feeling as merely a pleasant feeling, a temporary alignment of conditions that will soon dissolve, then the necessity of craving is negated.
Because you see it for what it is.
Precisely. We experience the data of the world without being enslaved by the demand to control it. Observing the feeling without tipping into craving is the crux of why this text is so vital for mindfulness.
But doing that requires an incredible amount of stability.
It requires a profound stabilization of the mind, yes. Under the influence of fundamental ignorance, the mind intrinsically believes that the pleasant feeling belongs to a permanent self.
I am feeling this. I need to keep it.
Exactly. And it believes that securing the object of that feeling will provide lasting security for that self. The mindfulness practice is not about suppressing the feeling.
Right, because the feeling is an inevitable result of contact. You can't stop the feeling.
You can't. The practice is about seeing the feeling with the clarity of wisdom rather than the obscuration of ignorance. When the feeling is known to be impermanent, dependently arisen, and empty of inherent existence, the cognitive error that fuels craving is corrected.
The fuel line is cut?
The fuel line is cut.
Wow. But when that awareness is absent, as it usually is for most of us, the craving metastasizes. Which brings us to link 9. The esoetra details that conditioned by craving, grasping arises.
Grasping.
If craving is the initial thirst, grasping is the frantic clenching of the fist. We solidify our desires into rigid identities, and the text unpacks grasping into four specific categories.
Grasping at desire, grasping at views, grasping at moral rules and vows and rights, and grasping at theories that assert the self.
Now, grasping at sensory desires and grasping at the illusion of the self, those are the obvious culprits of human suffering. Even grasping at views, you know, the ideological tribalism, the desperate need to be philosophically or politically right to validate one's existence.
We see that everywhere today.
It aligns perfectly with our modern observations of psychological distress. But I want to push back on one of these.
Please do.
Grasping at moral rules and vows. Within a spiritual tradition that is so defined by ethical conduct, monastic vows, and very precise behavioral guidelines, why does the Buddha locate morality as a potential mechanism of the very suffering he is attempting to cure? Isn't morality a good thing?
It is a profound safeguard against spiritual materialism.
Oh, spiritual materialism.
Yes. The inclusion of grasping at rules and observances highlights that the mechanism of clinging is dangerous, regardless of the object being clung to.
Even if the object is good.
Exactly. Ethical conduct is absolutely indispensable on the path. It calms the mind, prevents harm, and creates the conditions necessary for deep concentration and insight.
Right.
However, if a practitioner begins to view their adherence to moral rules as an end in itself, or worse, uses their strict morality to construct a superior spiritual identity.
I am holier than you because I follow these rules.
Precisely. Believing that the mere performance of rituals or the rigid following of rules possesses an inherent independent power to grant liberation. If they do that, they have fallen back into ignorance.
The dominoes keep falling.
The rules become a fortress for the ego. The raft built to cross the river becomes a heavy burden carried on the practitioner's back. The suffering is not in the morality. The suffering is in the psychological grasping that reifies the morality into an object of attachment.
That is such a vital nuance, clinging to the cure as if it's the goal.
Exactly. It keeps the chain reaction going.
And the psychological weight of that grasping, that relentless conceptual and emotional clinging, it culminates in the next link, link 10. Conditioned by grasping, existence arises.
Existence.
The Sanskrit term here is bhava, which translates to becoming or existence. We are looking at the ripening of the karmic process. The grasping has energized the volitional formations to such a degree that a new manifestation is inevitable.
The momentum is unstoppable at this point.
Right. The text points to existence within the desire, form, or formless realms, mapping the cosmological consequences of our psychological states. The mental momentum has gathered so much mass that it necessitates a physical or localized expression.
Bhava is the immediate precondition for birth.
Okay.
The mind, heavily conditioned by grasping and clinging to the illusion of a self, is terrified of annihilation. It propels itself toward whatever realm of existence matches its karmic resonance.
It's the energetic potential of a life yet to manifest.
Yes. Because the ignorance that sparked the entire chain was not eradicated, the standing wave of the aggregates is driven to reestablish itself once the current configuration fails.
Which leads directly to the physical realization of that momentum. Link 11. Conditioned by existence, birth arises.
Birth.
And the SOOTRA defines birth not merely as the emergence from the womb, but as a technical assembly. It refers to the conception, entrance, maturation, obtaining of the aggregates, obtaining of the elements, and obtaining of the sense sources.
The manifestation of the life faculty into a particular class of beings.
The hardware and software, the form and the name, are fused together into a new organism. And the inescapable tragedy of assembling anything composed of temporary parts is that it must eventually disassemble.
The final link.
Yes, link 12. Conditioned by birth, aging, and death arise. And the text strips away all euphemism here.
It is remarkably visceral.
It really is. It describes aging as becoming bald, wrinkled, worn out, slack. It describes the body as being hunched like a cow drinking water.
A very striking image.
Covered with liver spots, having drooping limbs, walking with a stick, feeling lethargic, losing memory, and becoming old and decrepit.
The clinical unvarnished language used to describe the decay of the physical form is entirely intentional.
It's hard to read, honestly.
It is, because we spend immense psychological energy attempting to deny the reality of impermanence. We dye the white hair, we obscure the wrinkles.
We construct elaborate societal mechanisms to keep the reality of aging and death out of our immediate field of vision.
Exactly. The SOOTRA forces the practitioner to confront the inevitable trajectory of the form aggregate. It shatters the delusion of physical permanence.
And it doesn't stop there. The text then defines death as the disintegration, the fading of bodily warmth, the cessation of the life faculty, and the discarding of the aggregates.
The standing wave loses the underlying conditions that held its shape.
And the waters disperse. The Buddha concludes the 12-part analysis with a statement of chilling clarity. In this way, this sole great heap of suffering arises.
The great heap of suffering.
The entire architecture of human misery, from the subtlest psychological anxiety to the physical reality of death, is traced back step by step to the initial failure to see reality clearly.
It's a diagnosis of the entire human condition.
It is. Now, looking at this incredible psychological and philosophical breakdown, I have to ask, how do we even have access to this today?
The history of the text is almost as fascinating as the philosophy itself.
I mean, this was spoken over 2 millennia ago.
Yes. And this exhaustive tracing of the causal chain is exactly why this specific teaching was preserved with such extraordinary care.
Right.
The textual history provided by the 84,000 Project reveals the immense effort required to transmit this exact sequence across millennia.
Where did it start?
Originally, it survived in Sanskrit as part of the Nidanasupta collection. And it was recognized by great Indian scholars like Vasubandhu and Gaukamadi as the absolute linchpin of Buddhist psychology.
They wrote commentaries on it, right?
Yes, extensive commentaries. It was not merely a philosophical curiosity, it was the diagnostic manual for the human condition.
And how did it spread from India?
Well, translators like Kumarajiva in the 5th century and later Xuan Sang in 661 CE undertook monumental, often perilous journeys to ensure these precise definitions were rendered accurately into Chinese.
That cross-cultural translation is a massive undertaking.
Enormous. Ensuring the definitions of ignorance, contact, feeling, and craving were perfectly translated. And the Tibetan translation, which we are looking at today, was cataloged in the Dhenkarma inventory by the early 9th century, specifically by 812 CE.
So it was already formally established in Tibet by then.
Yes. This history isn't just trivia. It demonstrates how essential this specific teaching was, considered across all of Asia. It was carefully preserved, translated, and debated by different philosophical schools for millennia.
Because the mechanism of suffering it describes is universally human.
Exactly. The preservation of this SOTRA was a cross-cultural imperative.
It's amazing to think about the lineage of scholars and practitioners holding this text through the centuries.
Handing it down generation to generation.
So bringing it all together for you listening, you are a participant in this cycle. This is taking place in Sam Esra, the cycle of continuous rebirth. But the text gives you the blueprint of the machine.
She shows you the gears.
Right. By seeing the 12 links, especially how contact leads to feeling and how feeling leads to craving, you gain the awareness needed to intercept the great heap of suffering. The profound implication of this causal chain is hidden within the structure of the formula itself. If this exists, that arises.
Which means the inverse is also true.
The inverse is the key to liberation.
Yes. If the condition does not exist, the result cannot arise. I always warmly remind practitioners that this text isn't meant to be pessimistic.
It can sound heavy with the aging and death and suffering.
It can. But analyzing the absolute dependence of every phenomenon means that if the causes are removed, the result must also cease. It is a schematic for dismantling the machine of suffering.
So if the momentum of formations is arrested, consciousness is not propelled into a new cycle.
Exactly.
If the gap between feeling and craving is guarded by wisdom, grasping cannot take root.
The fuel line is cut.
And most fundamentally, if the root condition of ignorance is eradicated, if we finally see that the self we have been defending is a dependently arisen illusion, the entire sequence collapses.
When ignorance is replaced by wisdom, the causal links lose their binding power.
Do the aggregates still function?
Oh, yes. The aggregates still function. The eyes still see, the ears still hear, and feelings of pleasure and pain still arise as biological realities.
But the suffering is gone.
Because there is no longer a deluded mind claiming ownership over those aggregates or demanding that those feelings be permanent. Craving and grasping do not follow.
So the organism just lives out its karma.
The organism lives out the remainder of its karmic momentum in a state of freedom, unburdened by the great heap of psychological suffering. The analysis of dependent arising is ultimately a teaching of profound hope, demonstrating that suffering is conditional. And whatever is conditional can be brought to an end.
We return then to the assumption we wake up with every morning, the feeling of being an isolated, enduring self fighting against the current of a chaotic world.
The illusion we all share,
The Esso Otra, teaching the fundamental exposition and detailed analysis of dependent arising, invites us to look closer at the machinery of our own minds. It asks us to investigate the split second where a pleasant sight turns into a burning desire, or where a fleeting thought of the past hardens into a rigid identity.
To observe the standing ways.
If the anger, the anxiety, and the exhaustion we feel are merely the downstream effects of a fundamental misunderstanding, we possess the capacity to correct the error. We are not trapped in the suffering. We are actively constructing it.
And if we are constructing it, we hold the power to dismantle it.
By examining the conditions of our own experience with relentless honesty. So I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder as you go about your day.
A very important question.
If everything about you, your body, your speech, your mind, your very consciousness is just a temporary name and form arising dependently on prior conditions, then who is the self that is actually doing the grasping? If the self is an illusion born of ignorance, perhaps letting go of it isn't a loss of who you are. Perhaps it is the ultimate freedom.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.